Just a quick note on this episode. The ways we think about ourselves and refer to ourselves, and the way we want others to think about us and refer to us, is extremely important. In today's episode, one of the people you'll hear from is a citizen of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi Indians. The language and terms you'll hear in this episode are the ones he prefers. I'm Curious City's Jason Mark. Last week, we dove into the question about why there are no Indian reservations in Illinois. To find the answer, we looked back at the history of this region from the late 1700s through the 1830s. It was a period marked by armed conflicts, numerous treaties negotiated under pressure and coercive tactics, and eventually, the removal of most Native Americans from this area in 1833.
Illinois was just too good of a land to bother to share with Indian peoples, and so we all got removed.
And of course, the Native people often didn't understand the terms that the U.S. negotiators were using. It's a really coercive process.
I think it was either, sign this treaty, give up this land, or die.
There are newspaper reports from the time that most of the people were made to walk. People died along the way, particularly the sick, the old, and the very young babies. And they oftentimes wouldn't allow people to even stop and do a burial. You just had to keep moving. And so it becomes a death march.
Now, last week's episode closely examines the end of an era, but what about the decades, the centuries even, leading up to that time? That's something Mark Lichty wanted to know more about.
One of the ways I try to relate to any place where I'm living is to try to understand what it was like in the past.
Mark's a cultural anthropologist, and he's also interested in history. And he knows before Chicago was officially established as a city, thousands of Native Americans were living in the area. But Mark believes that our history books pretty much ignore these people.
The fact that most Chicago histories begin in 1830, yes. That says it all.
So today, we're going to revisit a story from reporter Jesse Dukes. He'll help us understand that Chicago simply wouldn't be Chicago as we know it without the people who lived here before European settlement. That's next.
Curious City is supported by the Poetry Foundation, with a reminder that Chicago is the pulse of poetry. Visit the Poetry Foundation on the corner of Superior and Dearborn to explore their library of 40,000 books, attend public events, and view Frente a la Vida, Facing Life, a striking multidisciplinary art exhibition by Chicago artist Victoria Martinez. Learn more at poetryfoundation.org.
So Mark wants to know more about how Native Americans fit into the history of Chicago, their impacts on today's world. And there's a familiar way to answer Mark's question. We could focus on remnants from Native Americans, the diagonal streets like Milwaukee Avenue or Vincennes Avenue that were Indian trails before they were Chicago streets, or the Indian names we see all over, Wabash, Washtenaw, Skokie, Michigan, or Chicago. But after researching this, I think there's something else worth thinking about, that the most important remnant of Native Americans in Chicago is actually the city itself. That Chicago, one of the country's most important economic centers, a great transportation hub, might not exist as we know it had it not been for Native Americans. In fact, I think we need to consider Native Americans as important as the French and American men who the history books traditionally name as founders. To explore that idea, we're going to look at three eras. One where only Indians lived here, one in which Indians traded with Europeans and other visitors, and one after most Indians were pressured or forced to leave the region. In each of these eras, we'll look at how Indians took advantage of the region's geography, engaged in trade, and used intermarriage in ways that put Chicago on a path to becoming a major American city. We'll start with somebody whose family ties to the region predate the city of Chicago.
We have a saying that we walk on the bones of our ancestors, and we say that with pride.
This is John Lau.
I am a citizen of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi Indians.
Lau's a professor of history and American Indian studies.
My grandmother told me that we've been here since the beginning of time. The latest archaeological evidence, though, indicates that we probably migrated from somewhere in Ontario about 1,000 years ago.
Lau explains that for hundreds of years, his people, the Potawatomi, were one of several Algonquian language-speaking tribes living in villages scattered throughout the region. They traded, intermarried, got along.
It was quite a cosmopolitan area. And all of these people we treated as our cousins. We didn't have a lot of history of warfare or conflict. We had similar worldviews, similar spiritualities. Now we had the Iroquois to the east and the Dakota to the west. They're not Algonquians, and we did not get along always as well with them.
The Potawatomi were also expert builders of birch bark canoes.
The birch bark canoe was an ingenious bit of indigenous technology. It allowed us to travel a great distances very quickly, as they moved so quickly along the top of the water that they were like wave eaters. They were the Jaguar or the Lamborghini of transportation.
The canoes allowed the Potawatomi to take advantage of Chicago's geography. Only a short distance separates the Chicago River, which connects to Lake Michigan, from the Des Plaines, which eventually goes to the Mississippi. Indians could carry or portage those light canoes over that short gap and have access through waterways to upstate New York, the Atlantic coast, the Mississippi River, or the Rocky Mountains. And well before European traders showed up, it was open for anybody to use.
There was nobody controlling that portage. The land is Mother Earth. You can't own it. It's like owning the air, owning the stars. You can't do it. But you can have a claim to territory that this is where my family's always picked blueberries, and we'd appreciate it if you don't come and pick our blueberries. Same thing with fishing.
So territories, villages, but an openness in geography that made Chicago an ideal place for trade.
There is always trade. People are always interested in getting things from somewhere else. Fascinating things, useful things, beautiful things, powerful things, spiritual things. There's been found copper from the Upper Peninsula. There's been found mica shells from the Gulf of Mexico. There's been flint found from the Rocky Mountains. It comes from only one place, Yellowstone.
So, before European traders showed up, Indians had already established Chicago as a trading center. When French explorers Louis Joliet and Jacques Marquette arrived in 1673 to explore the Mississippi River looking for trade routes, Indians showed them the Chicago portage. Joliet and Marquette are recognized in the history books, but it's the Indians who showed them how Chicago connected the east to the west and the north to the south. A new era came to Chicago in the 1790s. That's when the first non-native permanent settler, Jean-Baptiste du Sable, arrived. He's another man who now gets cited in the history books as one of the founders of Chicago. Du Sable was probably mixed race, of French and Afro-Caribbean descent. He set up a trading post and cabin at the mouth of the Chicago River, and other traders later moved in nearby. Susan Sleeper Smith is a historian who studied how that trade worked.
The image that most people have of traders is that they have a little store, right, with a little counter, and behind it are all the goods. That's not how it works. Trade works this way. Indigenous societies trade with kin. They do not trade with strangers. Du Sable has no ability to trade with Indian people just because he has trade goods. He has to have a wife.
Du Sable, smartly and quickly and rightly, marries a Potawatomi woman.
That is his kin entree into the trade. And he would be primarily trading with her kin relations.
Du Sable and the other traders brought goods from warehouse cities like New Orleans, Montreal, or Albany. They traded for fur with their Indian allies, often their in-laws, and they took the fur back for more trade goods. that cycle could take 2 to 3 years, and Susan Sleeper Smith thinks DuSable probably timed it to spend the winters with his wife and her family. We don't know much about DuSable's wife. She was baptized as Catherine. Their marriage lasted 30 years. They had at least 2 children. Susan Sleeper Smith says marriages like the DuSables empowered Potawatomi women, but they weren't just about business.
These are mostly young men and young women. And if you're in your 20s, you probably don't want just a business relationship with a woman. Her ability to distribute goods, her ability to get fair prices for her kin, gives her tremendous prestige. I mean, if you are married to a trader and you are translating, I mean, DuSable doesn't come into the Great Lakes and speak Potawatomi. He needs someone to translate for him.
So DuSable is considered a founder of Chicago, the creator of a permanent settlement. But he couldn't have been a successful trader without his Potawatomi wife, Catherine. So maybe she's a founder too. The trading post the DuSables established grew into a small trading village in the early 1800s, right at the mouth of the Chicago River. From 1800 to 1830, a few hundred people lived there, many in mixed marriages, like the DuSables. Trader Antoine Wilmette, for instance, lived with a Potawatomi wife, Archange. Now, non-Indians weren't really supposed to be there, according to treaties. It was Potawatomi land, but John Lau says the Potawatomi were okay with a few traders in the area.
Trade made life easier. It was a lot easier to cook in a kettle pot than do the boiling with rocks in a clay pot. Firearms made hunting a lot easier. The clothing, the Potawatomi in particular, were fashionistas. We developed this style. I'm not sure where it came from, but apparently at some point we decided that we loved wearing turbans, which makes me laugh. We're making a lot of money. We were a very powerful tribe. We were thriving. We were doing much better than the settlers were.
That didn't last. By 1830, the U.S. government decided it wanted all the lands east of the Mississippi, and the Indians would have to go. They pressured leaders of the Potawatomi, as well as Ojibwe and Odawa, to sign the 1833 Treaty of Chicago. It stated that in exchange for some land west of the Mississippi, and promises of cash payments, some never fulfilled, nearly all of the Indians living around Chicago would have to leave. The Pokagon Band of the Potawatomi negotiated an exception, but otherwise, most Native Americans left. So when our questioner Mark points out that Chicago histories tend to start in 1830, this is what he's talking about. Those histories ignore the fact that before the Indians were displaced, they contributed to the establishment of Chicago. I brought this idea to historian Ann Keating. She studies how Chicago transitioned from a tiny multi-ethnic trading settlement to a vast industrial city during the 1800s. And she agrees, Native Americans were important.
The layering of the Indian era, of the Potawatomi and their forebears on this landscape is certainly one that creates patterns and traditions that continue from one era to the next.
The Potawatomi traded in Chicago, so did Europeans and Americans. The Potawatomi farmed wheat and corn, so did American settlers. And perhaps the biggest contribution was the knowledge Indians imparted about how to take advantage of this region. That portage again that connected the Great Lakes to the Mississippi.
I would give Americans credit to have figured it out eventually, but what the Potawatomi were already doing made itself evident to Americans who came into this region that these roots were incredibly valuable.
That knowledge of Chicago's geography led to a canal planned in the 1830s, built in the 1840s. That drew investment and people to Chicago. The canal led to Chicago's becoming a major railroad hub, and soon, the great Midwestern metropolis. If the Indians hadn't shown Chicago's potential to Europeans and Americans, maybe they'd have figured it out. But maybe Milwaukee or St. Louis would have gotten a head start and become the great Midwestern metropolis. And we might have a much different Chicago today.
Curious City is supported by the Poetry Foundation, with a reminder that Chicago is the pulse of poetry. Visit the Poetry Foundation on the corner of Superior and Dearborn to explore their library of 40,000 books, attend public events, and view Frente a la Vida, Facing Life, a striking multidisciplinary art exhibition by Chicago artist Victoria Martinez. Learn more at poetryfoundation.org. WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
You can learn more about the history we covered on today's episode. We've got a list of books and resources to check out on our website at wbez.org/curiouscity. Now, Curious City is more than just a question and answer machine. It's a space where Chicagoans and the people who love the city come together and learn about each other from each other. A space to recognize the importance of diverse communities in creating this unique place we call home. And you can take a more active role by sending us your questions about Chicago and the region. Just go to wbez.org/curiouscity and tell your friends. Thanks to Jesse Dukes for reporting this story. Curious City is produced by me and Joe Dassault. Linda Lutton reports for Curious City. Maggie Civet is our digital and engagement producer. Our interns are Sophia Lowe and Paloma Moreno Jimenez. Alexandra Solomon edits the show. Curious City is supported by the Conant Family Foundation. I'm Jason Mark. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you back here next week.
Rise and Shy, WBEZ is serving local stories for breakfast every weekday morning from 5 to 11. Tune in on the WBEZ app to hear what Chicago's talking about as you start your day.